forced her to duck to one side instead of following up in my moment of vulnerability. Directly toward Stan. No! I said. She seized his throat, and her hand flexed. As quickly as that, Stan's labored breath stopped completely as she closed off his windpipe. That predator looked out at the doctor's face, and its blue eyes danced with amusement.
"I'll kill him," she said. "One move, little man, and I will end his life."
"Don't," I breathed. Her smile widened a little as she regarded the sword, still humming with the power of an angry chorus. Silence stretched.
"I was like you once," she said finally.
Something ugly went through those blue eyes.
"Struggling to protect them. What a fool I was."
"Yeah?" I asked. "Look, we don't have to be doing the combat thing. Be glad to talk with you about it. Coffee, maybe some nosh. What do you say?" She sneered.
"Do you think I care about your thoughts, little mortal?"
"How will you know if you never hear them?" I asked mildly. Whatever I'd said, it was the wrong thing. Pure rage flared through her features.
"So righteous," she spat.
Then she looked me up and down and said,
"I offer you a trade for his life."
I said, "I'm listening."
"Give me your glasses."
That made my heart all but stop. Suddenly, that scared 10-year-old kid inside me was screaming again.
"Give me," Miyamune purred, "your glasses. Or I kill him. Right now."
"If I do," I said quietly, "you walk away. You leave him alone."
"For as long as you live and breathe," Miyamune said.
I swallowed. Stan was here because of me. I took one hand off the sword and reached up. The world dissolved into a blur of vague color as I took off my glasses, and my stomach jumped and twitched in random spasms of pure, unfiltered childhood fear. I felt the glasses in my fingers, heavy and cool. Then I tossed them toward the last place it seemed like Miyamune had been standing. There was no sound of the glasses falling. She must have caught them silently. A second later, there were crackling, popping sounds, and the sound of safety glass pattering to the floor in little squares, like so many oversized grains of sugar.
"Little protector," Miyamune said a moment later, "I will make you suffer. I give you as long as it will take me to shoo the mortals from this floor. Then I will hunt you. I will feed on you. And in the end, I will take your life."
There was a clack as the door unlocked. Then it opened.
"Run," Miyamune said softly, "and others will die in your place."
Then the door closed again. The whole time, her feet never made a sound on the floor. But I had that feeling, that certainty you have when you're standing in a room that isn't otherwise occupied. My legs gave out, and I found myself sitting helplessly on the floor next to Stan's bed as he whimpered in his nightmares. The light of the sword went out when I hit the floor. I sat with him in the blind gloom. I was breathing too fast, and making sounds just like him.
"Yo," answered a voice when I speed-dialed 1 on my cell phone, by touch. "Harry's taxidermy. You snuff him, we'll stuff him."
It's me, I said. The levity vanished from his voice.
Butters, what's wrong?
I said. I am the wrong person to be a Knight of the Cross, is what I wanted to say. But instead, I said, what are you doing?
You just caught us. Getting set to take Maggie and Mouse to the zoo to meet Mighty Moe,
he replied, his voice holding gentle cheer.
Gonna be a good time. You ever been to the zoo?
Not really an animal guy, I said.
You should come along, maybe,
he said. I felt myself laugh weakly. I can't. Working.
Which hat you wearing?
The Jedi hat, I said.
Oh, he said.
He was quiet for a second, then exhaled slowly.
Guess they're starting you early. How bad?
It's bad, I said. I might need help. There was a long silence from the other end of the phone. It hissed and crackled with static. He was upset. Wizards play merry hell with electronics around them when they get emotional. Even on an old landline, nothing was a sure bet, especially not around Harry Dresden.
I won't come, he said quietly.
What? I asked. Harry?
Michael told me something once that I thought was utter crap, he said. But I'm going to tell it to you now.
What? I demanded.
You're a knight now, Butters. You're working for the freaking Almighty, and he won't give you a burden bigger than your shoulders can bear.
Harry, he already has, I said. I didn't say it, honestly. I sort of gibbered it.
Butters!
He snapped. I'd heard him use that tone of voice one other time. Exactly once. It had been in a basement, and zombies had been coming to kill us. Polka will never die, I breathed. It came out smooth and automatic. It was a kind of mantra of mine.
Good man, he said. Tell me what's going on.
I did. I stuttered a lot. I stammered a lot.
Wait, he said. The thing's shadow. A lion's mane and a damned elephant's trunk?
I thought of the thrashing tendril in the thing's shadow. Yeah, I guess it could have been.
And it had blue eyes, didn't it?
I hadn't gotten to that part yet. Yeah, I said. It did. They were crazy.
Hell,
he said.
It's a Bakabaku.
What is that? I asked. I've never heard of that creature.
Because it isn't real, he said. Or it wasn't, until the 90s. I mean, there was a thing called a Baku in Japanese lore, but it wasn't the same thing at all. Look, some company made a kid's stuffed toy, called it a Dream Eater, said that it was a magical protector that ate bad dreams before children could have them. Came with a little book that explained the whole thing.
I'm fighting a stuffed animal? I asked. My leg pounded. There would be a huge bruise there for weeks where the thing had kicked me.
Nah, he said. Look, they were just making a toy, but they gave it to kids. Kids believing in things has freaking power. It either created the real ones or it gave access to something similar from the Never Never that used that belief to create a place for itself in reality.
Then why has it gone all Manson on these people? I asked.
Some laws are kind of universal. Like, you are what you eat,
the wizard told me.
You eat enough nightmares, sooner or later you turn into one. Now, instead of protecting people from nightmares, it uses them to inflict torment. Probably gets energy from it.
Oh, fantastic, I said. What can they do?
Listen carefully. This thing has laid a fear whammy on you, man.
That stuff doesn't work on knights, I said.
Horse crap, Harry said. Look, The knights have power, but you have to choose to use it, man. You don't get any get-out-of-jail-free cards. What you get is the chance to fight when other people would get eaten. That thing has gotten into your head. It's scaring you to death. Just like those people around you. It's eating you.
Harry, I can't see, I stammered. And I swear to God, he shifted into a nearly perfect imitation of Alec Guinness in the original movie.
Your eyes can deceive you, he said. Don't trust them.
I barked out a laugh that felt like it was going to shatter something in my chest. Or maybe actually did. Suddenly, I started to get my breath back.
Butters, he said. Look, I know it's hard, but there's one way you deal with fear.
How? I asked him.
You stand up and you kick it in the fucking teeth, he said.
And there was a quiet, certain power in his voice that had nothing to do with magic.
You've forgotten the most important thing a knight needs to remember, Butters.
What's that? I breathed.
Knights of the Cross aren't afraid of monsters, he said. Monsters are afraid of you. Act like it. Commit to it. Hard. And have faith.
Act like it. Commit. I could do those things. Faith was harder. I'd never asked God to help me handle things before. But I had faith in my friends. One friend in particular. Got it, I said quietly. I guess I'd better go, Harry. Got work to do.
Good hunting, knight.
Thank you, wizard. When I opened the door, things had changed. I'd taken a white sheet from Stan's bed, draped it over my shoulders, and tied two corners around my neck. On the part of the sheet that draped over my chest, I'd taken a first aid sticker from a drawer of supplies beside the bed and stuck the Red Cross symbol over my heart. It wasn't like Sonya's or Michael's cloaks, but it would do. More important, I'd put my headphones in my ears, plugged the jack into my phone, and blared Weird Al Yankovic's Now That's What I Call Polka at full volume on loop. I could barely see, and I couldn't hear anything but my goofy, beautiful polka, one of the songs I knew perfectly at that, which was kind of the point. In the hallway, I could feel the emptiness stretching out around me and the low fear in the air. The Bakabaku had run everyone off the floor. I could dimly see hollow yellow squares retreating, tracking the workmen and nurses and doctors all leaving the floor by the stairs and elevators, leaving it to just the two of us and the trapped, dreaming victims. The fluorescent lights were all flickering and flashing as if they needed changing. I didn't see the hostile red targeting carrot, but I didn't need it. I went to the center of the hall, lifted the sword to a high guard, and felt it ignite and change the way shadows fell on the hall. As Yankovic translated popular music into polka in my ears, I shouted, Bakabaku, betrayer of children, you have lost your path. Come and face me. And I closed my eyes and waited. You see, magic isn't really magic. I've spent a lot of time studying the theory, and I know that for a fact. I mean, it is magic, obviously, but it doesn't just happen in a giant vacuum, inexplicably creating miracles. Lots and lots of magic actually follows many of the physical laws of the universe. Energy can neither be created nor destroyed, for example. If the Bakabaku was sending magical fear into people's brains, that fear had to be transmitted by something. It can't just appear magically, poof, in someone else's head. It's a kind of broadcast, a signal. And that means that Like other magical broadcasts, such as those used on the communicators I'd designed and built in the past, waves on the EM spectrum were the most likely culprits for those transmissions. Using those things had a side effect of causing distortions in nearby cell phones. It was even more noticeable in headphones. So, I listened to one of my recent favorites and waited. My inner 10-year-old was screaming at me to run. I told him to shut his mouth and let me work. And, sure enough, about the time Al was singing about looking incredible in your granddad's clothes, I heard the sound distort suddenly in my left ear. Moving quickly is not about effort. It isn't about making every muscle explode in an instant in an effort to be fast. It's about being relaxed, smooth, and certain. The instant I heard the distortion, my body just reacted, turning and sweeping the sword down, all in a single liquid motion. I felt the sword hit, and the blade's hum shifted to a triumphant note. I opened my eyes to see a shape about the size and same general coloring as Miyamune, reeling back. There was a much smaller, flesh-colored shape lying on the floor not far from my feet. I tugged out the earphones and heard Miyamune let out a moan of pain, and the last of my fear fell away from me. The Bakabaku bounced off the wall and fell, and I advanced on it, slow and steady. The creature's huge, weird shadow spread onto the wall behind it, even as its human face stared up at me.
"Who are you?"
the creature asked. The words that came out of my mouth only sort of felt like my own.
"Ehya, Asha, ehya," I said quietly.
The walls of the empty hallway quivered slightly as the words washed over them, even though I never once raised my voice. The creature just gaped at me. "Even now," I heard myself say, "it isn't too late for you to turn aside, to be forgiven." I couldn't really see its expression, but I saw the gathering tension in its blurry form, felt the anger in the way it suddenly exhaled and came at me. And the sword of faith swept down one last time and ended it. When Michael picked me up from the hospital in his old white pickup late that night, I was exhausted. He handed me my spare pair of glasses first thing, and I put them on gratefully. "I have to do something about that," I said. "Maybe sports goggles."
"Seems like a good idea," he said. "How's Stan?"
"He'll be fine," I said. "So will the kids."
"What was hurting them?"
"Something that should have been protecting them," I said quietly. I squinted out the window as he pulled away. Just dissolved into nothing when I took it down.
"What's wrong?"
he asked me, his deep voice gentle. "I'm not sure I succeeded at this quest," I said. "I kept trying to reach out to the creature, to give it a chance to turn away."
"Sometimes they do,"
Michael said.
"Mostly they don't."
"It's just," I said, "killing is such a waste. What I did was necessary, but I'm not sure it was good."
"Killing rarely is," he said, "at least in my experience. Could you have done any differently?"
"Maybe," I said. "I don't know. With what I knew at the time, I don't know."
"Would they all be alive if you had done differently? The children? Stan?"
I thought about it for a moment, and then shook my head. "I don't think so."
"Then be content, Sir Knight," he said.
"Didn't even have to get my hand cut off to get there," I said.
and leaned my head against the truck's window. I never knew it when I fell asleep, relaxed and unafraid.
Zoo Day. I never really meant for Harry to be a dad. I mean, I knew what I was doing on a step-by-step basis. I knew that for changes, I wanted to throw out an extinction-worthy threat from the bad guys and a proportionate response from Dresden. For Harry, the ultimate motivation would be saving his own child, especially because of his own childhood experience as an orphan where no one ever came to save him. And it was kind of baked into the cake of my unconscious assumptions that Harry would save his child, of course. Clumsy though the young wizard might be, and sloppy and desperate and uncoordinated, and I really feel like the word collateral needs to be worked into it somewhere, Dresden does tend to get the job done in the end. But I never really paused to work through the implications of the fact that Harry would be pathologically devoted to being there for his kid, and that he was going to save her life. I could see both twos, but I had never added them up to four. Maggie was going to be there, a presence in the story moving forward, and he was definitely going to want to be involved with her, which meant that my hard-boiled, unlucky-in-love PI wizard was also going to be a parent. Which, of course, changes absolutely everything about one's life. It restructures priorities in a way nothing else really can. Which is something that is really, really contraindicated when you're writing a long-running series. You don't go majorly changing your main character without facing a loss of audience. The easy, safe thing to do would have been to leave Maggie with the Carpenters or shuffle her off into the church's supernatural witness protection program, which seems like quite a wizardly thing to do, maybe even for the child's own good. But as I kept writing, I realized that I couldn't do that and still have Dresden be Dresden either. He believes too much in what it means to be a parent, as shown in the Bigfoot short stories, and the payment he demands from Rivershoulders. So, at the end of the day, the character was a-gonna change one way or another. I went with the way that felt most true to who he is as a human being. Harry's a dad now. He might not know too much about it, but at least he has the jokes down.
My name is Harry Dresden. I am possibly one of the more dangerous wizards alive, and I have never once spent a whole day as a dad. My memories of my father are few and faded. He was a good man, and he was kind, but he died before I got into first grade. Sometimes I wonder whether the memories I have of him are mine, or they're just the stories I've been retelling myself my whole life. The point is that I don't really have much in the way of a personal role model to base my dad technique on. The man who mostly shaped me was a sadistic monster, and by the time my grandfather came along, Ebenezer wasn't parenting so much as enacting psychological damage control. And besides, I'm pretty sure you don't dad a furious, sullen, magically powered teenage boy the same way you do a 10-year-old girl. Not only that, but I was pretty sure I'd never really spoken to a 10-year-old girl for any length of time, nor had I ever been one. I was completely in the woods here, and sure of only one thing. I really, really wanted to get this right. Maggie walked next to me, taking maybe 3 steps to every one of mine. She was a tiny child, in the lowest possible percentile for height and weight, in every class she'd ever been in, with pale skin, dark hair, and absolutely enormous dark eyes. She was wearing purple pants and a beige T-shirt that bore an image echoing the original Star Wars poster, but done in the style of Edo period samurai art, and her shoes flickered with little red lights when she walked. Next to her paced a granite-gray mountain of muscle and soft fur named Mouse. Mouse was a genuine temple guardian, a foo dog. He weighed about 250 pounds, and the length of his fur was something like a mane around his neck and shoulders. He wore a red nylon vest that declared him a service dog, and walked as carefully as if he were avoiding baby chicks with every step. Maggie kept one of her little hands buried in his mane and her eyes on the ground. "So you haven't been to the zoo before?" I asked. Maggie shook her head and watched an elderly couple pass on the sidewalk. She waited until they were several yards away before saying quietly, "Miss Molly tried to take me once, but there were too many people and too much sky, and I cried." I nodded. My daughter had seen some bad things. They'd left their marks on her. "That's okay, you know." "Miss Molly said that too," Maggie said. "I was little then." The spring afternoon sun peeked out from some clouds for a moment, and my shadow engulfed her and enough space for 5 or 10 more of her. "That was probably it," I said. "But if you need to, we can leave whenever you like." She looked up at me for a minute, her face thoughtful. She was the most beautiful child I'd ever seen. But everyone thinks that about their kid. Maybe everyone is right. "I want to see the gorillas," she said finally. "So does Mouse." Mouse wagged his tail in agreement and looked up at me with a doggy grin. "Okay, then," I said as we approached the entrance to the zoo. "Let's do that." Maggie looked at me for a moment more and frowned before saying, "Are you nervous?" "Why would I be nervous?" I asked. She looked down and shrugged. "I don't know. I'm nervous. I haven't ever gone to the zoo with my dad before. What if I do it wrong?" I felt a little jab in my chest and cleared my throat. Smart kid. "I'm pretty sure this isn't something you get right or wrong." "What if, I don't know, what if I set something on fire?" "Maybe we'll roast some marshmallows," I said. She didn't laugh, and she kept her face down, but her cheeks rounded up with a smile. "You're weird." "A little," I said. "Is that okay?" "I don't know yet, I think." She stepped a little closer to Mouse. She could have ridden on his back and he wouldn't much notice her weight. Did you really save the gorillas from a monster?" "Yeah, pretty much," I said. It had been 3 hags, and I'd saved 1 gorilla from taking the fall for a murder one of them had perpetrated. A couple of people died. But that was a lot of dark and complicated conversation for my first dad-daughter outing. Maggie nodded seriously. "So you like animals, like me?" "Yes, I do." "Even dinosaurs?" "Especially dinosaurs. And dino dogs." "Woof," said Mouse, pleased. I leaned across Maggie to ruffle his furry ears. A group of noisy children in private school uniforms came trooping by, and Maggie flinched and withdrew into herself until they'd passed. After that, she stared grimly at the busy entrance to the zoo, looking for all the world like someone a great deal older who badly needed a cup of coffee. Then she sighed, squared her shoulders, and said, "Okay, let's see some animals." So we did. There was a spectacularly good showing from the animals in their various enclosures. The otters played with bombastic fervor. The tigers prowled back and forth at the very front of their pen. One of the polar bears stood up on his hind legs, and a sun bear enthusiastically tore apart a log just as we came walking up. I mean, if I hadn't known better, I would think they were putting on a show. Maggie was enchanted, her little face stretching up into one quiet smile after another, though she rarely stepped far enough away from the dog beside her to cease being in physical contact with him. The lion actually roared, a sound that shook the air and sent a dozen people scurrying a few steps back, but not Maggie. Though she flinched whenever anyone walked too close to her, she regarded the lion with an intent gaze as the beast finished his pronouncement and shook his mane with lazy majesty. "Awesome," she said after, and her smile was a sunbeam. "Yeah," I said quietly, "awesome." The actual lion's roar had been a little too much. There was no way all the animals would be showing off like this without some kind of intervention. And I knew I hadn't done it. I eyed Mouse with some suspicion. The dog noticed and dropped his jaws open into a guileless canine grin, panting happily and wagging his tail. I arched an eyebrow at him and shook my head. The beastie was full of incompletely understood yet helpful magic, but he couldn't play poker to save his life. Get it? The dog? Playing poker? That's an art joke. I may not know humor, but I know what I like. We had just turned to head toward the gorilla house when my day started getting complicated. I felt it first as a series of flickering sensations against my forehead. It reminded me of a moth fluttering against a lit wall. Constant and random flutters, somehow conveying confusion, frustration, and fear. The hairs on the back of my neck stood up, and a quick check around showed me at least three different people who were suddenly perplexed that their electronic devices had started malfunctioning. Magic was in the air, and it wasn't coming from me.
Dad?
Maggie asked me. I eyed her. She was looking at me in mild confusion. Then I saw her eyes widen as she had some kind of realization, and she moved to stand with Mouse on one side of her and me on the other.
Is there something bad?
I felt my shoulders tighten into iron bands. Damn it. This day was supposed to go smoothly. Just dad and daughter time, where Maggie knew that she was the most important thing in the world to me. God knew I'd been away from her long enough. The last thing I needed was for her to think I took my job more seriously than I took her. But at the same time, wizarding work wasn't the kind of thing that came with regular hours, or dental insurance. Also, there was the minor issue that the moral obligation to do the right thing didn't suddenly go away due to inconvenience. Maybe, I said. I looked at her. Maybe nothing. I don't know. I need to look around and see what's going on. I need to put you in a safe spot before I do that. Maggie stared at a spot in the middle distance, chewing on her lower lip. It's important, isn't it? Maybe, I said. I nodded toward the cafe that served the zoo. How about we go get a booth and order some food? You and Mouse sit, and I'll go look around and be back before the food gets there. Maggie's arms tightened around the dog's neck. She looked at him, then at me, and nodded her little chin firmly. Yeah, I guess that's okay. How about it, Mouse? I said. Can you behave yourself around food? My dog was staring across the park in what would have been considered a pensive expression had we all been cartoon characters. He made a noise in his chest that was part whine and part rumble. Trouble, boy? I asked. It wasn't cliche dialogue. Mouse was better than me at sensing trouble coming, and had proved it on multiple occasions. He stayed staring for a minute, then exhaled slowly and looked up at me. His ears perked up and he wagged his tail. I took that to mean that all was well. All right, I said, and wagged my finger at him. Be good.
Woof,
Mouse said.
He's always good, Maggie said and kissed his ear.
She had to lean down only a little to do it, and he lifted his head obligingly. Okay, I said. We got seats in the restaurant, and I ordered some French fries and left Maggie with a 20 to pay for more if she needed it. I made sure she was comfortable, got Mouse settled in at her feet and strode briskly outside, carefully opening my wizard's senses. Magic is a living, breathing force. But nothing makes it stir and swirl as much as human beings, and especially human emotion. Based on what a given person is feeling and how strong an emotion they are experiencing, magic can quiver and pulse like the cover to a rock concert speaker, vibrating hard against the senses of anyone born with the ability to sense it. More people have that than you'd think. Folks who get unexpectedly creeped out in the woods, who sense that something seems particularly ominous about a darkened parking garage, who sometimes feel something in the air that grates against them and makes them abruptly cross the street for no particular reason. They're mostly gifted with sensitivity. If they trust their instincts,
Such senses can help them avoid no end of possible trouble. For example, I could, with a little concentration, feel an intense and unpleasant sense of unease off to my right, along one of the park's paths. Even as I watched, I saw half a dozen people either swerve off to one side, apparently distracted by something else, or else simply change their minds and not follow the path. Their instincts were serving them well. My instincts frequently roll their eyes at the decisions my brain makes. I walked firmly, directly, into the unpleasant energy and started looking for trouble. I found it within 50 yards, in the shadiest part of the path, where the park's trees and bushes and the walls of the various buildings and enclosures hoarded a cluster of shadow that shouldn't have been quite as dim as it was. A young man in a black hoodie stood in the shade, hands thrust deep into his pockets. The air around him pulsed with anger and fear that was near panic. The air around him thrummed with tension and energy, far more of it than a vanilla mortal should be able to emit. He was slender, and though I could only see a bit of his face in profile, the acne was visible enough. Stars and stones. A warlock. Magic sort of bursts onto the scene with most youngsters who find themselves in possession of talents and powers that must seem as if they simply emerged from a beloved series of children's novels. Ideally, word of such gifts gets to the White Council, who dispatches someone to make sure the emerging talent receives training appropriate to prevent them from doing any harm with their powers. The ideal was too rare, and getting rarer. As the population increased, more and more gifted children were emerging, and it was just possible that the group of 300-year-olds who commanded the White Council were somewhat slow to adapt to changing conditions among mortal kind. When a child fell through the widening cracks, their talents could emerge in frightening, even violent ways, often to a degree that they were forced to flee their homes and communities. Those kids were then forced to cope with life alone and their emerging talents all at once. A lot of them used their gifts in the worst ways, unforgivable ways. Kids like that were known as warlocks, and the council dealt with them harshly and permanently. I stared at the kid for a while. I'd been that kid for a while. Then I did something I don't do very often. I turned my back and walked away. "What was it?" Maggie asked me when I got back. She looked nervous and wiggled a bit in her seat. I debated whether to play it down. She didn't need to be any more anxious than she already was. But enough time in the saddle as a wizard had taught me that there are bad repercussions when I keep people in my life in the dark, even when I'm only trying to protect them. I looked down at her open, earnest face and her huge eyes. Yeah. I didn't need to start off my relationship with my daughter by repeating some of my classic mistakes. "A warlock," I said quietly. "A young wizard whose power is not in control. Dangerous." Her eyes widened. "Did you fight it?" "Him," I said. "No." "Why not?" she asked. "Because most of the time they never meant to do anything bad," I said. "They don't even understand what's happening to them. No one has warned them what will happen if they break the rules." "That's not fair," Maggie said. "No," I said. "But that doesn't make them any less dangerous." "Can't you help?" "Sometimes," I said very quietly. "I'm not sure." She picked up a French fry and dipped it in a large mound of mustard, not ketchup. "What?" She licked the mustard off the fry thoughtfully and then said, "But I'm here." "Yeah," I said, "and you're more important to me." She darted a look up at my eyes and smiled a little. Then she said, "They just get powers?" I nodded. "Born to it, yeah." She nodded again and asked, "Am I going to get powers?" "Maybe," I said. "There's no way to know for sure." "Weird," she said. She passed the French fry to Mouse, who snapped it up. She picked up another fry, dipped it in mustard, and began to repeat what was obviously a well-rehearsed cycle. If I do, will you teach me stuff? So no one gets hurt? If you want me to, I said. She chewed her lip, looking intently at her fingers. If something happens to you, who's going to teach me? An invisible boxer socked me in the gut. Nothing's going to happen to me, I said. It could, Maggie said quietly. For those two words, her voice sounded older. Way too old for the little body it came from. And maybe there wouldn't be anyone. Maybe I'd be a warlock. I took a deep breath. She'd seen her foster family murdered. Horribly. And maybe she'd seen even worse. She knew what the world could be like sometimes. She'd probably seen worse than that kid in a black hoodie. Maybe, I said. That could be me. She nodded to herself several times and took a deep breath as if getting ready to hold it. Then she looked up at me. I can eat more French fries. Mouse will keep me company. You sure? I asked her. It could cut today kind of short. If someone needs your help, you help them, Maggie said simply. Even when it's really hard. Miss Molly told me that about you. Her eyes were searching, studying. I'll be damned if the kid wasn't assessing me warily, watching for my reaction. So young, yet so cynical. She must get it from her mother, sighed. Yeah, I said, feeling my face stretch into a smile. Yeah, that's right. I went back down the dark path, walking briskly. The thing about warlocks is that they really are damn dangerous. Without even knowing what they're doing, they can turn their wills to the pursuit of black magic. And that has a degenerative, addictive effect on their psyches. Warlocks, caught in the grip of black magic, did the kinds of things that give coroners and psychologists nightmares. They don't absolutely have to go completely off the rails, but most did. People in that frame of mind, suddenly confronted by the White Council's wardens, rarely chose to put up their hands and come quietly. I remembered when the wardens had come for me. Scary guys. If I hadn't been so exhausted, I'd have been just one more warlock slain while resisting arrest. Maybe this kid was a dangerous monster. The sheer malice radiating from him was convincing enough. Or maybe he was just a terrified kid. I walked up to him quietly, my footsteps audible, cleared my throat, and said, Hi. Hoodie turned to me, gave me a half glance, and snarled, Get out of here! There was a force of magic in his voice, subtle power that tugged at my ear. Made me want to lift my foot, pivot, and go the other way. It wasn't a very coherent compulsion. I waved it off with a defensive gesture of the fingers of my left hand. Whoa, kid, I said. Save it for the tourists. You and I need to talk. That got his attention, pronto. His spine stiffened and he spun toward me, on one heel, his shoulders tightening. He wasn't tall, maybe 5'6", and his shoulders were almost comically narrow, hunched up like that. I sidled up and leaned a hip on the railing a few feet out of arm's reach in front of him, crossing my arms. When did it happen? Year ago? Year and a half? He had that wary poise of a wild animal, balanced and waiting to see which would be the best way to flee. His eyes were focused on the center of my chest. Who are you? Someone who had the same thing happen, I said. One day, things changed and everything got weird. I thought I was going insane. So did my teachers. You a cop? The kid asked, his voice suddenly sharp. Kind of, I said. I didn't do nothing, he said. I barked out a quick laugh. Wow, you are not good at this. People who are innocent don't have to walk around saying it. His face reddened and darkened at the same time. You better be careful, asshole. Or what? I asked him. or something bad is going to happen to you. Nah, I said, won't turn out like that. That ticked the kid off. His jaw clenched so hard that I thought he might crack some of his teeth. His fists clenched with audible popping sounds. At the same time, the air grew thicker and tighter and more threatening, and there was a sudden rippling sensation against my skin, as if someone had abruptly torn a long strip out of the fabric of my blue jeans. Then there was a sound in the greenery, and my skin began to crawl on the back of my neck. I came on balance in an instant. Remember those instincts I was talking about earlier? Mine were telling me that something dangerous had just come into the world. The kid staggered suddenly and dropped to his knees, panting. Then his head came up, his eyes wide and everywhere. Oh, no, he breathed. Oh, no, 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 no. Oh, for Pete's sake, I muttered, understanding what had happened. The kid had a strong magical talent and a gift for summoning. Magic is mostly in your head. And unfortunately for anyone who's got to deal with us, human beings' heads are murky, conflicted places. All kinds of things are going on in there, a lot of them under the surface, a lot of them not entirely in our own control. Hoodie's subconscious had gathered up all that anger and fear he'd been feeling and sent it spiking out of him like a kind of spiritual beacon, a beacon that had attracted the attention of something from the spiritual world, something that had just crossed into the shadows of the walkway. The spirit world is the home of an unlimited variety of supernatural beings. But I was going to take a wild guess and assume that this one wasn't a placid herbivore. Right here, in the park? I demanded of the warlock in an aggrieved tone. Hell's bells, kid. Hoodie just stared at me with frightened, confused eyes. That spiritual dinner bell he just unconsciously rung had taken a lot out of him. I didn't mean to. I never mean to. Then his eyes widened. You have to get out of here. Run. First lesson, I said. I took a couple of steps back from the kid and peered around the thick greenery, relying more on my wizard senses than on sight or hearing. Running away from your problems rarely gets them solved. You don't get it, Hoodie babbled. It's coming. It's coming for you. You don't get it, kid, I responded. I had a second's warning, maybe a little more. It came through the greenery, staying in the heaviest shadow it could. It erupted from the dark and took Hoodie's legs out from him as it went by. I had the flickering impression of a wolverine's squat, powerful legs, a head too wide to be anything from this world, a thrashing, scaled tail, and crocodilian teeth. It went through the kid and straight for me, bounding for my throat. I was already moving as it came. I swept my arm up in a vertical line, fingers locked and rigid like claws, as I channeled my will into them and barked, Apaturum! My fingers peeled back reality as they swept up, tearing open the veil between the mortal world and the world of spirit. The berserk whatever it was from the never-never, the spirit world, let out an abrupt, abbreviated shriek of frustration as it hurtled directly into the opening, passing from the mortal world and back into the spirit realm again. Insturebus! I shouted, whipping my hand back down along the rend, this time inverting my will and sealing closed the opening before the vicious little thing could turn and leap back out again. I could feel the normality rush back in to seal over the rend in the veil, and could faintly sense several thumping protestations from the hungry spirit creature as it found itself sealed away from the mortal world again. After a few seconds, the shadows seemed less thick, and the sun emerged from behind the clouds, sending golden shafts streaming onto the path. Hoodie lay on the ground where he'd fallen, staring up at me in silence, his mouth open. I walked over to him and dropped down to squat on my heels, resting my hands on my knees. As I was saying, I said, you don't get it, kid. I'm the guy who is ready for it. I'm a wizard. I offered him a hand. He took it, and we rose together. He pulled away from me quickly and scowled, but not precisely at me. What do you want? To talk, I said. What if I don't want to talk to you? Guess you don't have to. That made him turn a shade warier. I could just walk away? Sure, I said. From this close, I could smell the kid. He needed a shower. His clothes didn't look like they'd been changed in a while. His shoes were too small and worn out. I gestured toward where the demon he'd accidentally summoned had been banished. But how's that been working out for you so far? I'm fine, he said. His voice cracked when he said it. He looked away. Well, I'm not going to make you get help. You hungry? I asked. As the conversational gambit went, it was a pretty solid one. Kids were hungry about 95% of the time. No, he lied, his tone sullen. There's a restaurant not 2 minutes from here. My daughter is there, with my dog, eating French fries. But I could just murder a burger right now. How about you? Hootie didn't say anything. People had begun to resume using the pathway, and the everyday world began to reassert itself more firmly. Look, I kind of am a cop, I said. Just not for the usual stuff. For special things. Like today. He shifted his weight warily. Tell you what, I said. Let's eat. Maybe talk a little. You gotta be tired of dealing with this stuff on your own. He bowed his head at that, so I couldn't see him tear up. I'm Harry, I said, and held out my hand. He eyed my hand, and then me, huffing out half of a laugh. Wizard Harry? You're kidding. Nope, I said. I looked at him and lifted a speculative eyebrow. Austin. Austin, the warlock said. He might have been 13 and a half. Hi, Austin, I said as gently as I could. It's nice to meet you. Hey, have you ever seen the gorillas here?
Hi. My name is Maggie Dresden. My dad is okay, I guess, but I wish he were a little more up on his monsters. It's not his fault, I'm pretty sure, on account of he's a grown-up, and grown-ups can be awfully dumb about some things, mainly the creeps. Grown-ups are about as thick as you can be when it comes to the creeps. Normally, you don't see a lot of them out on a summer day, but today they were everywhere. An elderly couple who had been taken by bagglers walked by. I don't know if that's their actual name. Me and Mouse kind of made up our own as we went. But there were shrouds over their heads, like a couple of dirty old paper bags that you could kind of see through if you looked hard enough. Bagglers weren't really all that dangerous as creeps went. I had a theory about them, that they just fed on the brain energy of people who talked about politics too much. And made them want to talk about politics more, because that's just about all that came out of their mouths. You just watch. First chance they get, bagler people start talking politics. You'd think even grown-ups could be interesting with some kind of psychic monster eating their faces all the time, but you'd be wrong. So, there you go.
So you haven't been to the zoo before? My dad asked.
My dad was a pretty scary-looking guy, if you didn't know him. He was bigger than anyone else had ever seen. With scars and dark hair and muscles. I mean, kind of long, stretchy muscles, but you could tell he was strong. Plus, he was a wizard. I mean, most people don't believe in magic and monsters, which just shows you that most people are pretty dumb. For a grown-up, he didn't seem too stupid. And he kind of liked me. You could tell sometimes when he talked or looked at me. I liked that a lot.
I waited until the bagler couple were far enough away so that they wouldn't overhear us, just on general principle, before I said, Miss Molly tried to take me once, but there were too many people and too much sky, and I cried. I waited to see what he would think about that. My dad fights bad people and monsters professionally. I didn't want him to think I was a big chicken. I mean, we were just getting to know each other, but sometimes things get really, really loud or really hectic and fast-moving, and I just can't deal with anything. It helped to have Mouse with me. Mouse always understood when things were getting too big and tried to make me feel better.
My dad seemed to think about his words for a minute before he said, "That's okay, you know." "Miss Molly said that too," I said, with that same little pause before she said it. I really didn't want him to think I was crazy. I wasn't crazy. It was just that sometimes it was really, really hard to keep from screaming and crying. I slowed down a little so I could stand in the shadow where it was darker and cooler. Summer in Chicago is hot. I was little then. "That was probably it," he said. I liked his voice. It rumbled in his chest and sounded really nice. When he read to me, it sounded like that voice could go on steady all night long. "But if you need to, we can leave whenever you like." I looked up at him. Did he really mean that? Because today was looking brighter and louder and shinier every minute. My ears were already itching with all the noises around us, until I just wanted to jam my fingers into them and close my eyes and shut out everything. But today was my first day together with my dad. We'd never done that. The Carpenters had been really, really nice to me and given me a home. I loved them. But they weren't my dad. I'm sure he would take me somewhere else if I asked him, but I didn't want him to think I was just some little baby who couldn't even go to the zoo. Mouse, walking next to me like always, walked a couple of inches closer, reassuring me. Out of the corner of my eye, I saw his jaw drop open in an encouraging doggy smile, and his tail thwacked against my back when he wagged it. My dad was pretty strong. Maybe I could be strong, too. "I want to see the gorillas," I said. "So does Mouse." Mouse wagged his tail even harder and smiled up at my dad. He smiled at me. The smile really changed how he looked. It made him look more like a dad, I think. "Okay, then," he said. "Let's do that." He said it the same way that you hear soldiers say, "begin operations" in the movies, and his eyes flicked about, checking all around us and into the nearest trees overhead in maybe a second, as if hunting for a monster to blow up. I'm pretty sure he didn't even realize he was doing it. My dad has fought bad things for a long time. He's seen bad things happen to people. Miss Molly says that that kind of thing leaves wounds, but you can't see them. Sort of like how grown-ups can't see the creeps. But she said he carried them without complaining, or letting it stop him from helping people, even when it was really, really hard. Sort of like being around me. I try to be a nice person, but when things get too big, it's hard to do anything very well. Other kids mostly stay away from me. Even when I can make friends, sometimes they don't really understand. Maybe he wouldn't understand either. He already had a hard job. Maybe being my dad would be too hard. "Are you nervous?" I heard myself ask. He blinked at me. "Why would I be nervous?" He was looking at me like he really liked me. I couldn't keep looking at him when he was like that. What if he changed his mind? Things can change. So fast. "I don't know," I said. "I'm nervous. I haven't ever gone to the zoo with my dad before. What if I do it wrong?" He walked along next to me for a second, and then I felt his fingers brush against my hair gently. "I'm pretty sure this isn't something you get right or wrong." Which would make sense if I didn't have to worry about turning into a complete spaz if things got too big and loud. What if, I don't know, what if I set something on fire? "Maybe we'll roast some marshmallows," he said. Which was the kind of goofy thing you'd expect a grown-up to say, but it was nice to hear him say it. "You're weird." Mouse leaned against me with a little huff of a breath that he used when he thought something was funny. He was clearly pleased, though I thought he was a little distracted, too. Must be because Dad was here, and he really, really liked Dad. Dad saved him from a monster when he was a tiny puppy, and then Mouse grew up and helped Dad fight monsters, and then Dad gave him to me to be my protector. Mouse was good at that. The creeps mostly didn't bother me, and the particularly old and nasty underhide that had moved into the space beneath my bed had found out the hard way that you don't mess around with Maggie and Mouse Dresden. Dad was talking to me about how he had saved a gorilla once, and was leaning over me to pet Mouse when we all but walked right into an entire tribe of haunts. These had taken a